This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Your Dangerous Liaisons is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Good.
And I love that you came back to Atonement, and I wanted to know, since you have been, so you're such a brilliant writer, and you also went to direct, what was for you the reason to direct, except for writing?
Well, I started directing, I directed my first film, Carrington, really because the designated director disappeared at the last minute and left us holding the baby. And we had French producers, one of whom rang me up late one night and said, you know, in France it's very common for writers to direct. I said, oh no, I've never wanted to do that. And he said, well, you know, we've got the money, we've got the actors, that you've been waiting to make this film for 17 years, which I had, so why don't you just do it? And then I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole process of directing very, very much, and went on and did another film, The Secret Agent, the following year. In 2003, I did Imagining Argentina. Well, if your films don't perform at the box office, it then becomes rather difficult to persuade people to back you again, particularly as the subjects that I'm interested in are always slightly commercially questionable, you know. So it's been quite hard to resume directing, which I would like to do in due course. Yeah.
So do you find directing more satisfying than writing, or is it just?
It's more fun than writing. I really wasn't expecting to enjoy it so much, but I like very much the sensation of working with a team of good people, and all three of my films have been most, you know, really enjoyable for me, and I hope for everybody else involved. So, and it's great. It is, you know, it's. But I do take I do think of myself, I suppose, primarily as a writer. And, you know, if you direct a movie, it takes a year out of your writing schedule. So you don't want to do it all the time. I don't particularly want to just become a writer-director. I'm very happy with a project like Atonement to work with someone else, because it's not necessarily the kind of film that I would like to direct.
How difficult was it to adapt the book?
Well, it was very difficult, actually. It was very difficult, and we kind of progressively made it more difficult for ourselves, because we started to cut away all the things that we started with, like a framing device, which we'd started with, where the story began with the old writer coming back to her childhood home, which was now a hotel, and, you know, we got rid of the voiceover, because once we'd established that she was an old... You know, she was old Bryony. We had her appearing from time to time in the course of the story and commenting on it and speaking about it, and we'd made the story a sort of more linear than it is now, and all of those things we sort of disassembled and rethought, and so it just got more difficult as it went along, really, because I think to tell the story with all its nuances, particularly in the first half of the film, without any explanation, without any voiceover, without any kind of contemplation of what was going on, was really quite a, you know, tell it visually, really, was what Joe was interested in, and it was quite demanding.
Can you talk about your writing process? Are you like a 9-to-5 writer? Do you think that some writers talk about the golden period where they have 3 hours where they can, they're very,
For me, it's sort of between 3 and 6 in the afternoon. That's when I'm at my best. Most of the writers I know like to get everything over by lunchtime. Then they can have the rest of the day free. But I tend to use the morning to, you know, think about what I did yesterday and modify it if necessary and plan. And then I like to write in the afternoons. But I do like to. I'm quite a sort of compulsive writer now. Over the years, I've become much more dependent on it in a sort of way. I like to write, you know, most days whenever I can. You know, I feel comfortable having written for a couple of hours a day.
What is it about novels that inspires you to continue trying adaptations?
Well, I mean, this was a rare. It's only happened to me two or three times, but this was a rare example in that I read it, you know, on vacation somewhere at the end of 2001, and by the time I got to the end of it, I thought I'm absolutely sure this would make a great movie, and so when I got back to England, I contacted my agent and said, you know, I'd like to do Atonement. She said, oh, there's quite a long line, and Ian McEwan, being as he was the executive producer, had retained the right to consultation, and indeed, really, effectively, it was his choice as to who was going to do the script. And so I met him and told him how I felt about the book and what I felt we should do in the course of adapting it, and got the job through him. But it was really my response to the first reading of the book that triggered the whole thing.
Can you give us an update on the Coco Chanel?
Coco Chanel project is something I've never done before. I'm a consultant. A French friend of mine, Anne Fontaine, who's a very good director and usually writes her own screenplays, is making this film about Coco Chanel and working with a young French writer. But she's never done a period picture before. And she asked me if I would go at the beginning, which I did, in the middle, which I'm about to, and then just before they start shooting, to spend a week brainstorming with them and going through the whole script.
They have a pretty big actress playing in the film.
They do.
And so are you tailoring, or are they tailoring it for her, or is it going to be more...
No, I don't think so. I don't think they're tailoring it for her. She happens to look very like Coco Chanel. And I haven't met her, but apparently she's very smart as well, which is good. I mean, I know Stephen Frears, this is Audrey Tautou, has worked with her and has nothing but good to say of her. So no doubt she'll have her input as well. But this is something I haven't done before, which is to just be a kind of godfather to a project.
Well, what
is biography another sort of adaptation? Because you do have to fit it into a sort of three-act structure.
You do, but I mean, from Carrington onwards, I always, in fact, from Total Eclipse onwards, which is the first bio piece that I did, I've always found it to be the case that what really happened was much more interesting than anything you could invent. So I have always tried to, you know, tell these stories without making anything up, to tell these stories as they really happened. And then it becomes a technical task of organizing the material. I mean, the first draft of Carrington was at least 4 hours long. It could easily have been a miniseries, and had all kinds of characters like Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster, and all of which I got rid of as eventually the story itself began to sort of emerge from this massive material. It is quite difficult. I mean, I'm doing a film at the moment with Frank Darabont, based on the story of Tokyo Rose, who was a Japanese-American woman who was arrested in Tokyo right after the war, brought back to San Francisco, put on trial for radio propaganda, and sentenced to 8 years imprisonment. And she was completely innocent. It was all a witch hunt. She was absolutely innocent. And eventually in the 70s, she was given a presidential pardon by President Ford. And in order to... I started off with a 200-and-something page screenplay because I felt, you know, there was so much material. And her trial happened to be the longest and most expensive trial in American legal history at the time, in the late 40s. So there were 54 volumes of trial transcript and 6,000 pages. And so it's all been, you know, I'm slowly the contours of the story are beginning to emerge, and I'm starting to know what I can throw away and what I have to keep and what I don't need. But that's with a biographical project, With the Coco Chanel project, they've very wisely just concentrated on like 2 years of her life, just before she became, as it were, became Coco Chanel and opened her first boutique in Paris. And so that contains the subject, that makes it a little bit easier. But if you're doing somebody's whole life, or a big, you know, several years of somebody's life, it's always selection and shaping that needs to be done.
With this project that you're doing with Frank, so you're writing this for Frank?
Yeah.
And what's he like? Because he's very famous for being a writer.
Yeah,
and
he
director.
Is.
So what's it like writing for a writer?
It's great, actually. It's great. He's very sympathetic. I said to him when we first met, I said, well, why aren't you writing this yourself? And he said, well, you will have noticed that I'm whatever age I am, and I've only made 3 movies. And I would like to make some more movies, and maybe I have to get someone else to write them, because it takes me so long. So we're not... I think he was wrong if he thought it was going to be quicker working with me. Because we've been on it a couple of years already, but...
I was going to say, where is the project in his arsenal of...
Well, we've had to suspend everything because of the strike, so... but what we had intended to do was to get together once the mist opened, which it just did, and we can't do that now until the strike's over, so...
But I think what Steve means is he also has Fahrenheit 451.
Yes, he does.
Coming up, and he also announced The Long Walk, another Stephen King adaptation.
Yes,
so
that's right.
Tokyo Rose.
Well, hopefully between Fahrenheit 451 and... because Fahrenheit 451 is his passion project,
yeah,
that he's had, you know, on the front, you know, waiting to go for years and years and years. So so he's very, very excited about that. But we'll see. I mean, we'll see how... You can never predict with...
You were at some time also attached to do adapt Edith Wharton Custom of the Country.
I did it.
What happened to it?
What happened to it? That's a very, very good question. It's actually one of the 2 or 3 best scripts I ever wrote. I was very, very, very happy with it. And my publishers, Fabers, actually published it, which was very nice of them, even though the film wasn't made. I did it for Sony, and we got quite far down the line... and I wrote it for Michelle Pfeiffer. And then, not anyone's fault, but she suddenly rang up and said that Scorsese had asked her to do The Age of Innocence. And I said, well, you won't want to do 2 Edith Whartons, will you? She said, oh, they're completely different. Yes, of course I will. But what happened was that The Age of Innocence, which I considered to be a really fine film, was not very successful and lost everybody concerned a certain amount of money. And so they decided they weren't going to do it. So it was put on one side until Sense and Sensibility came out, and then suddenly it looked as if period pictures might be. And so it was all on again, and another round of, you know, meetings with the studio and so on ensued. And then I think some other picture came out, maybe Portrait of a Lady, I can't remember. Some other picture came out, which
so
then
it's
didn't...
It's still available to be made?
It's still available to be made, and I'm still really... I would love to make, you know, I know, I mean, it's the closest thing of anything else that I've ever done to Liaison Dangereuse,
it's a great book.
People behaving badly, which mm-hmm. which audiences always enjoy.
What do you think is going to happen with the writer's strike? Can we hope for a quick resolution this month?
There's some rumblings of optimism at the moment, we're always hoping that, but it's a really important strike, I think, that it's really important that these principles are established.
Can you give us a little synopsis of this Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell?
Yes, it's a... Well, no, I can't, actually. It's a 850 pages of... and, in fact, I'm not working on that anymore. I've been replaced with Julian Fellowes. And it was for a reason that I'm sort of familiar with, which is really that they wanted to depart too far from... the original, for my taste. I went as far as I could with them, and then I said, "Look, I don't think this is. I think this is making a mistake." So again, it'll be a long road, and who knows what's going to happen. And I have worked on things before where I've been fired, and then they've asked me to come back again, and I've worked. I must say, this is quite interesting. I've been None of the things I've been fired with from have ever been made. But this may be the exception, because I know they've invested a lot of hope and money and so on in it. So, but it is a most fascinating book about the revival of witchcraft or wizardry in England in the early 19th century, around the time of the Napoleonic Wars. And it's an extremely original book that this that the author, Susanna Clarke, took 10 years to write. And it's her first book. And it's really unlike anything I've ever read. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating subject. It is 850 pages long. So any film will necessarily be a pretty, partial view of the piece. But
before the writer's strike happened, were you working on anything else?
Yes, I delivered just before the writer's strike. Although I don't know technically whether it's affected by the writer's strike or not, but I've written a screenplay for David Cronenberg, based on a play of mine called The Talking Cure, which is a play about the early years of psychoanalysis and the relationship between Jung and Freud, and the relationship between Jung and one of his female patients, a Russian woman called Sabina Spielrein, who herself became an analyst in later life. And it's a really fascinating story that I started to research 6 or 7 years ago, or more probably. And I happened to come across the case notes. Somebody gave me the case notes what was in effect the first time Jung ever used Freud's method on a patient. And it's really, really interesting subject matter. And David Cronenberg did not come and see the play, which we did in 2002 at the National Theatre in London with Ray Fiennes. But about a couple of years ago, he read the play and asked me if I would be interested in doing a screenplay of it. So the first draft is done of that.
Do you know if that was a project that David was aiming to do after the strike was resolved? Because every director is usually attached to 3 or 4 things.
Yes. As I understand it, he's doing an opera based on The Fly in Paris in the first half of next year. And then the hope is that he will do Talking Cure.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, no, I was going to add. Oh, no, okay. I'm going to finish. I want to go with another. What's it like working for... Do you notice that all these directors, from Frank Darabont to David Cronenberg or, Joe, whoever they are, they all have a similar... Is there something similar about all these successful directors?
No, there isn't, actually. They're as different as different can be. And I learned that early on in my career, when I was very lucky to work with, within a few years of each other. I did a movie, a screenplay for Fred Zinnemann and a screenplay for David Lean, both of whom taught me an enormous amount. Neither of the films were made. But they couldn't have been two more different... two more different men with two more different philosophies, and there are as many different ways of going about these things as there are different directors, and every director has his own method, and some directors are extremely lucid and clear about what they want, and some are incredibly vague, and some, like Stephen Frears, exasperate you by saying, well, there's something wrong with this scene, I don't know what it is, you better fix it. Which he does sort of more or less jokingly, but he means it. But the one thing that I have noticed that all of the good directors the best directors that you work with have in common is that they're completely obsessive, and it doesn't stop. You don't hand in the script and they say thank you very much and go, and they work, they worry at it. There are scenes that they're never happy with that they keep wanting you to redo. There's an enormous amount of sort of ferocious concentration that goes into a successful movie, and directors are, I think, in many ways, in my experience, even more obsessional than writers.
How much were you on the set of Atonement? What did you make a lot of changes ongoing?
No, I didn't. I was hardly on the set at all, because unlike Stephen Frears likes you there every day. Joe. We went away together for several weeks, and we got this final version, and that was more or less it. I mean, I was around a little bit, put my head around the door to say hello to people, but but he knew what he wanted to do, and he was away doing it.
Kira said that he doesn't make a lot of changes once the script
no.
is locked.
No, he made very few changes, and he did. I mean, I think there were two or three times where he rang up and also emailed me and said, you know, let's look at this scene again in view of this or in view of that. But on the whole, he shot what we had, you know, he shot our final shooting script.
Have you ever made a change to a scene that you were not happy with, the director wanted? Not in this particular film, in other films that you disagreed with the director and but you went ahead and made them. I mean, as a writer, is that I would assume that that's a difficult thing to do.
You know, I must have done, but I can't quite. I'm quite adept at not right. You know, finding a third way. Really, if the director wants something and I want something different, on the whole, what I try to do is not what the director wants. If I don't think it's a good idea, mm-hmm. but some I try to see what it is that's troubling him and find a third or a fourth solution. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's no good my trying to write a scene that I don't feel. Is right. I've tried it before. There's a very good story about Harold Pinter writing The French Lieutenant's Woman, and Carol Rice, the director, said to him, "Man, we need a scene where the lovers are at least happy for, you know, a scene or two. We just want to see them being happy together." And Harold sort of scratched his head and thought for a minute, and he said, "I'm afraid I don't do happy."
It must be intimidating though to even say to Harold, you know, yeah. "You need to make some changes."
Yes, but I think you know, nowadays it's things have changed. I mean, I think I've talked to Harold a lot about this, and you know, in the old days he put the script in and they did it word, you know, comma by comma. But I don't think that happens anymore. I think even he has understood that the world has moved on since those days. I mean, there are David Mamet has the famous deal where he does one draft and, you know, you do what you like with it. That's quite a good deal to have. But I like to stay on board.
Thanks, everyone.